Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the October 30th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a bedroom scene at night. On the bedside table is a scary-looking jack-o'-lantern lighted up. It's actually carved like President Trump's face with his mouth open like he's screaming at somebody. In the bed, sitting upright, is the Democratic donkey with a terrified look on his face. He's got sort of dream bubbles above his head, or thought bubbles. And one of them shows, they show two newspaper headlines. One says the Washington Post, Trump wins. And the New York Times headline is, polls wrong again. Our headline is, haunted. After Trump's upset in 2016, can Democrats trust the polls? And I think our first main story is related to that. We'll start there. Millions of voters casting early ballots. With 2 weeks to go until Election Day, voters shattered records for early balloting this week, as passion stirred by Donald Trump's divisive presidency sent Americans streaming to the polls. Some 42 million votes had already been cast by Tuesday, according to the U.S. Election Project, nearly a third of the total number of votes cast in 2016. In states that offered a party breakdown of the early votes, registered Democrats outnumbered Republicans by 2-1. Voters in some states endured long lines. In Georgia, some waited as long as 11 hours on opening day. I really wanted to make sure that my voice was heard, said Everlene Rutherford, who stood in line for 10 hours in Marietta, Georgia. I want to see a change in this country. Biden leads Trump by roughly 10 points in aggregate national polls, with varying leads in every swing state, and close margins in GOP strongholds such as Georgia and Texas. Trump's campaign is low on cash after burning through $1 billion, with just $63 million in its coffers at the start of the month, compared with Biden's $177 million. Trump is being outspent on TV advertising by 2-1. Trump embarked on a flurry of campaign rallies, where he aired his grievances against the media and attacked his rivals. Appearing before largely maskless crowds in former red states, now turned purple, such as Georgia and Arizona, Trump called Biden a criminal, encouraged a locker-up chant aimed at Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and disparaged the government's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, as a disaster. He lashed out at a Supreme Court decision to let stand a Pennsylvania court ruling that denied a GOP bid to cut off counting of mail-in votes that arrive after Election Day, a major victory for Biden. It's crazy, Trump said. As Trump barnstormed, Biden's campaign manager, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, issued a memo to donors warning of complacency, saying the race remains neck and neck in key battleground states and is a lot closer than pundits suggest. Wisconsin Party Chair Ben Wickler said the Democrats still suffering from trauma over Hillary Clinton's shocking defeat in 2016, have a deep-rooted sense that anything could go wrong at every moment. What the editorial said. End our national crisis, said the New York Times. The worst president in modern history. Trump has damaged our standing around the globe. abused the power of his office, and engaged in rampant corruption and incompetent statecraft. He's a racist demagogue who's made America more polarized, more paranoid, and meaner. On November 3rd, voters must repudiate Trump and all that he stands for. It's the first step in repairing the damage he has done. Conservatives have our work cut out for us, said National Review. For the first time in a decade, Americans could find themselves living under all Democratic rule. On issues from health care to immigration, the Democratic Party has taken a leftward lurch that Biden, a politician of weak convictions, won't resist. If Election Day brings disaster, we can thank Trump. While he's done much to further conservative goals, his managerial incompetence on the coronavirus pandemic and his character defects now threaten to drag conservatism down to a consequential and avoidable defeat. What the columnist said. This isn't 2016, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. In that race's final days, undecideds shifted decisively toward Trump. But polls show there are few undecideds in this race. Biden has far better favorability ratings than the divisive Clinton, and his lead has been much more stable. Trump can't catch Biden without stealing support from Biden, which he hasn't been able to do. Don't count Trump out, said David Siders in Politico.com. Early Democratic gains could be offset by a Republican wave of in-person voting on Election Day. Republicans have an edge in new voter registration. Only a few points separate the two candidates in several swing states, and questions linger about the accuracy of polls and the number of shy Trump voters who might not talk to pollsters. Many mail-in ballots may be disqualified on technicalities. Anxiety-ridden Democrats are right to worry. Trump isn't acting like he even wants to win, said Matt Lewis in thedailybeast.com. Instead of drawing in wavering voters, he's doubled down on unhinged tweets and offensive rhetoric while failing to negotiate a pandemic relief bill that would have aided desperate Americans. He couldn't be hurting himself more if he tried. We're overthinking this campaign, said Tim Alberta in Politico.com. The bottom line is this. Americans are sick of Trump's act. I've heard it from voters all across America. Even MAGA loyalists call his erratic behavior exhausting. Voters might have chosen Trump in 2016 as the candidate they'd rather have a beer with, but now he's the drunk at the bar who won't shut up. After 4 years, Americans seem ready to call for the tab. What next? Swing state polls predicting a Clinton victory were wrong in 2016, but pollsters say 2020 will be different, said Laurel White in WPR.org. Their review of their own methodology has led them to conclude that the people most likely to respond to polls tend to be college-educated Democrats. So pollsters have course-corrected their sampling this year. It's also important to note that nationwide polls were largely correct in 2016. Clinton came into Election Day with a 3% edge in the average of national polls. She actually won the popular vote by 2.1%. There's one pollster who predicts a Trump win on November 3rd, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. Robert Cahaley, who correctly called Trump's 2016 wins in Michigan and Pennsylvania, thinks that Trump haters are eager to give pollsters an earful, while his fans don't want to be bothered, skewing the numbers. Cahaley is going way, way out on a limb, but if he proves right, he'll be the new king of pollsters. The title of the controversy of the week is Hunter Biden, Real Scandal or Russian Dirty Trick? Here it is, right on cue, your October surprise, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. In a last-ditch effort to save President Trump's campaign, the Rupert Murdoch-owned New York Post last week published several bombshell reports based on emails, photos, and videos supposedly retrieved from a laptop that once belonged to Joe Biden's son, Hunter. The materials apparently depict the younger Biden smoking crack, having sex, and trading on his father's name to land a $50,000 a month job on the board of Burisma, a Ukrainian energy company, where his father was heading up U.S. policy in Ukraine. The Post claimed it had a smoking gun email from a Burisma executive thanking Hunter for introducing him to the then vice president. But the Biden campaign has denied the meeting ever took place, and 50 former intelligence officials this week signed a letter saying the supposedly abandoned Hunter Biden laptop reeks of a Russian information operation, like the hacked and leaked Democratic emails in 2016. As it happens, the Post obtained the materials from Trump's clownish lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who has been openly soliciting Biden dirt from shady pro-Kremlin characters in Ukraine for 2 years, including Andriy Deripaska, whom Trump's own Treasury Department has labeled an active Russian agent. If the emails are Russian forgeries, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post, then Joe Biden should say so. Instead, the candidate is refusing all comment beyond dismissing the story as a smear campaign. Don't voters deserve the whole truth about the Biden family's dirty deals in Ukraine? Another laptop email from 2017 discusses a lucrative Chinese business partnership with 10% of equity going to the big guy, presumably Joe Biden himself. The mainstream media is trying hard to bury this explosive story, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Desperate to protect Biden, major news outlets simply declared the story debunked without doing any work to debunk it. There's no scandal here, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Both Bidens have acknowledged the impropriety of Hunter working for Burisma, which clearly hired him hoping to influence U.S. policy. But two separate GOP-led Senate committees last month failed to find any wrongdoing by Biden Sr., who actually pushed Ukraine to crack down on corrupt companies like Burisma. He's made his tax returns public, and they show no payments from Hunter, China, or Ukraine. Intelligence officials say it's common practice for Russian hackers to mix in forged documents with real ones, and forensic experts have already flagged typographical anomalies in some emails that suggest fakery. It's also desperate, said Molly Jongfast in the dailybeast.com. The Post even stooped so low as to gloatingly publish texts in which Hunter berates himself for his drug addiction, and Joe calls him my beautiful son and counsels him. Only focus is recovery, nothing else. Do the bottom feeders in Trump world really think Americans will sour on Biden for loving his addict son? With another manufactured email scandal, Trump is hoping to make this election a close sequel to 2016, said Jeet here in thenation.com. But this time the mudslinging is not sticking. The media is viewing these dubious emails with the appropriate skepticism. In fact, the veteran reporter who typed up this pseudo-scandal for the New York Post was so suspicious about its provenance that he refused to attach his byline. Sorry, Mr. President, this is not Hillary's emails 2.0. History doesn't always repeat. Let's see what we've got in our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for winter swimmers, who develop higher levels of RBM3, a cold shock protein that may help delay the onset of dementia, according to new research from Cambridge University. Immersion in cold water, researchers said, may stimulate the growth of brain synapses. It was a good week for unidentified flying humans after the pilots of jetliners coming into LAX in Los Angeles reported for the second time in 6 weeks seeing a person in a jetpack flying by, this one at an altitude of 6,000 feet. The FBI is investigating. And it was a good week for the saved. After televangelist Pat Robertson told viewers God had informed him that Donald Trump will be reelected, sparking civil unrest and an Islamic war on Israel, followed by some kind of asteroid strike on Earth that ushers in the end times. But it was a bad week for Chicago, which has been named the most rat-infested city in America for the sixth consecutive year by Orkin Pest Control. Los Angeles came in second, and New York City third. It was a bad week for alpine mists after a coronavirus outbreak in Switzerland was traced to a single super-spreading yodeling concert attended by 600 fans. The vigorous yodeling apparently expelled clouds of aerosolized coronavirus, and the outbreak is now one of the worst in all of Europe, said Dr. Rito Neutsch. And it was a bad week for close encounters after singer Miley Cyrus said in an interview that she once made eye contact with an alien who followed her in a UFO that looked like a glowing yellow snowplow. Cyrus noted that the sighting came after she bought weed wax from a guy in a van in front of a taco shop. Oh, well. Short news piece before we move on. Judge blocks SNAP limits for the unemployed. A federal judge this week blocked a Trump administration rule that would have thrown almost 700,000 unemployed adults off the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps. Chief Judge Beryl A. Howell of the U.S. District Court called the rule, which would limit waivers of work requirements for SNAP recipients with no dependents, capricious, and said that it would result in exponentially increasing food insecurity for tens of thousands of Americans. The administration said that restricting such waivers to counties with unemployment rates of at least 6% would save $5.5 billion over 5 years. The rule was the first of three proposed that would, in total, remove an estimated 3.7 million people from the SNAP rolls. On the briefing page now, Putin's troubles. Holed up in his mansion, Russia's authoritarian leader is facing serious challenges both at home and abroad. Why is Putin in trouble? Russian President Vladimir Putin seemed to have achieved his wildest dream in the 2016 U.S. election when the Russia-friendly Donald Trump narrowly won the presidency, while benefiting from a concerted Kremlin campaign to hack and release Democratic emails and sow disinformation. Similar Russian interference helped bolster nationalist parties in Europe, including those that supported Britain's exit from the EU. While the former KGB agent succeeded in weakening Western democracies and dividing NATO, Russia itself has not materially benefited from its interference in other countries' politics. U.S. sanctions damaged the Russian economy and badly hurt the oligarchs on whom Putin depends. Over the past 6 months, plunging oil prices and coronavirus shutdowns have deepened the damage, leaving the Russian economy crippled. At home, a botched attempt on dissident Alexei Navalny's life has galvanized the opposition, while abroad, unrest in former Soviet countries, which Moscow considers its sphere of influence, is mounting. What unrest? Moscow is worried about the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the ethnic Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. Russia has sizable minorities of both Armenians and Azerbaijanis, as well as a mutual defense pact with Armenia, while Turkey is openly supporting Azerbaijan. Putin has called for a ceasefire but has refused to get involved. In Kyrgyzstan, anti-government protesters last week toppled the pro-Russian president Sooronbay Jeenbekov, just 2 weeks after Putin, in a rare in-person meeting, promised to do everything to support you as head of state. Most threatening is the uprising in Belarus, a country that Russia is bound to in a nominal federal union. Putin's support for longtime President Alexander Lukashenko, accused of rigging his re-election, has alienated many Belarusians. Huge weekly protests against Lukashenko show no sign of letting up, and Putin's nightmare is that the protest could embolden his own opponents. Who are Putin's opponents? In June, Russia changed its constitution to allow Putin, who has governed since 1999, the ability to run for two more terms, effectively making him a czar and abandoning all pretense of democracy. That amendment, Tatiana Stanovaya told Foreign Policy, signals a new era in Putin's rule that is much more conservative, less tolerant, more repressive. The following month, Sergei Fergal, the popular governor of the far eastern region of Khabarovsk, was arrested on politically motivated charges, and the region erupted in weeks of protest. Days later, Navalny released an investigative report on his blog detailing the corruption and vast wealth of Putin's envoy to the Far East regions. Deputy Prime Minister Yuri Trutnev further inflaming anti-Kremlin sentiment there. That may have been the impetus for Putin to attempt to kill Navalny. On August 20th, the activist was poisoned with an even deadlier strain of the banned nerve agent Novichok that almost killed double agent Sergei Skripal in London in 2018. Why go after Navalny? Russia has long been a country where members of the opposition die violently, said Sam Green, the director of the Russia Institute at King's College, London. Navalny has been a particularly irritating and dangerous opponent. His popular blog and YouTube videos, slickly produced and wryly comical, have exposed in startling detail how top Kremlin officials, including Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, amassed vast wealth through corrupt dealings. Lately, he has begun organizing strategies for smart voting, helping the opposition solidify around whichever candidate has the best chance against the Kremlin. His poisoning brought more EU sanctions, further hurting the economy. How badly off is Russia's economy? Western sanctions have erased more than 6% of Russia's GDP since the 2014 annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. This year alone, the ruble has lost 20% of its value. Russia is largely dependent on oil and gas sales, and the plunge in global oil prices, exacerbated by a price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia, has cost it tens of billions in revenue. The pandemic is delivering another major blow. Putin lifted the country's shutdown in May, and the virus has spread rapidly, giving Russia the fourth highest total of infections in the world. Poverty and hunger are widespread. There is mounting internal discontent, to say the least, over the economy, economist Igor Nikolaev told Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I have the feeling that this is going to make authorities increasingly nervous, and the risk of a domestic crackdown is becoming greater. What about the U.S. election? U.S. intelligence warns that Putin is again interfering on the side of Trump, using a range of measures to spread disinformation about Joe Biden and his son Hunter, and to undermine confidence in the validity of the vote. Yet given the Democrats' lead in the polls, Moscow is also preparing for a Biden win. State TV openly mocks Trump as Putin's poodle, while Putin himself has begun extending overtures to Biden, praising him for supporting an extension of the new START Arms Treaty. This is a very serious element, said Putin, of our potential collaboration in the future. We'll read a few of the best columns, starting with Trump keeps conspiracy claims coming. President Trump's conspiracy theories arrive with a bang and leave with a whimper, said Max Boot. The latest example is the faux unmasking scandal, the claim that members of the Obama administration did something nefarious when they asked for the identity of the Trump campaign advisor, Michael Flynn, who was caught in surveillance transcripts talking to the Russian ambassador about U.S. sanctions. Trump has issued innumerable tweets demanding jail terms for those responsible, with the right-wing outrage machine echoing his calls for prosecutions, calling it a bigger scandal than Watergate. Now comes the news that a federal prosecutor tasked with investigating the matter found no crimes or substantive wrongdoing. You'll hear no retraction from those who shamelessly flogged the unmasking scandal. They've simply moved on to pushing other phony scandals. Last week, Trump retweeted lunatic claims that President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden may have had SEAL Team 6 killed and that Osama bin Laden is actually still alive. He also gave aid and comfort to QAnon nuts, praising them for opposing pedophilia. Trump World's goal is to flood the zone with blank, distracting attention from Trump's real scandals with a barrage of insane accusation. It's pure McCarthyism. Biden plan would raise your taxes. Joe Biden promises not to raise taxes on anyone making less than $400,000 a year, said Jeff Jacoby. Don't fall for it. His tax hikes will get you too. If elected, Biden says, he and a Democratic Congress will repeal President Trump's 2017 tax cut and raise the top tax rate from 36% to 39.6% on incomes of $400,000 and up. One problem with this pledge, the Trump tax cuts actually did reduce taxes for the vast majority of Americans, not just the rich and corporations. The left-leaning Tax Policy Center and the Wharton School of University, Pennsylvania, have studied the Biden tax plan and found that while about 80% of the $4 trillion it hopes to raise over a decade will be paid by the top 1%, 20% will fall on everyone else. About 82% of U.S. households would get some tax increase. In addition, Biden's plan to raise corporate taxes from 21% to 28% will inevitably lead employers to hire fewer people and give smaller raises. Yes, Biden's plan would primarily soak the rich, but it won't be just the rich who end up bruised. This column is from Honduras. It says, find the good in colonial heritage. Hispanic Day, known as Columbus Day in the U.S., is a complicated holiday for Latin Americans, said Hector Martinez. The anniversary of Christopher Columbus' arrival in the Americas in 1492 is now known as the Day of Two Worlds in Chile, and the Day of Respect of Cultural Diversity in Argentina, and the Day of Indigenous Resistance in Nicaragua. While long ago we were taught to take pride in our Spanish heritage, today we are instructed to denounce the Spanish conquest as the looting of native mineral wealth and the extermination of millions of people. The history of Latin America, the new thinking goes, is written with the criminal pens of genocidal muskets and marked with the ink of indigenous blood. But can't we acknowledge the good with the bad? We were bequeathed the gift of Spanish, with which we can communicate with some 600 million people, as well as the beauty of Catholicism and the legacy of Latin philosophy and law. Our European heritage shaped the ideals of heroes such as Simón Bolívar and Rubén Darío, as well as those of many brutal dictators and bad rulers. We are, as Bolívar said, a middle species between the legitimate owners of the country and the Spanish usurpers. That is our inheritance, and we must learn to live with it. It's time for our feature article, The Last Word. Buying pandemic safety. Like the rest of the country, the rich in the nation's capital are practicing social distancing, said Mimi Montgomery and Jessica Sinman in Washingtonian. They're just doing it in luxury, with no expense spared. Dr. Brown said he would charter the plane himself. He was nervous. The patients wanted him at their summer home in St. Michael's, Maryland, to screen them for COVID immediately. But it was a Thursday in summer, and driving would take forever. Forget about taking the car. Instead, Ernest Brown, owner of Doctors to You, a Washington area concierge medicine group whose house yacht private jet calls start at $600 a pop, drove to Gaithersburg, Maryland, and hopped a puddle jumper to the airport in Easton, Maryland. The patients, who needed to be screened in order to meet with another VIP, sent a car to meet him. All told, Brown was at their waterfront estate for 10 minutes max. Results, negative. In certain worlds, this might seem ludicrously extravagant, perhaps somewhat sinful. But in Brown's, it was just another day during the pandemic. A months-long blur of screening VIP clients, along with their nannies, drivers, valets, and chefs. Sometimes the doctor will pop out of the Falcon Wing doors on his Tesla Model X in a Georgetown alley or a Potomac garage for a clandestine test. Some of these individuals work for government entities, said Brown. They don't want to be tested so that it becomes more public or potentially public. Because, look, you've had the news reports on the people in the White House coming back positive, right? So people want to get around that. His clients also prefer the out-of-sight parts of their homes because Brown's full biohazard gear might scare the neighbors. It is glaringly obvious when somebody's walking around looking like a Teletubby, he says. On one August day, he began with a 7:30 a.m. screening for a prominent D.C. chef, then an 8 a.m. appointment at an embassy, and a 9 a.m. meeting in the Chevy Chase garage to swab the last stragglers of a Nantucket wedding party. He'd already screened the bride. After that, he rushed to Fairfax County to test two diplomats. After 15 years in private pay medicine, Brown is savvy to the perks his patients prize. While interruptions and long waits have plagued many local testing sites, his clients typically get results by 6 p.m. the same day. Standard healthcare labs were too slow, so he worked his contacts and found a small Maryland biodefense lab with the best testing capabilities. Brown hand-delivers all his samples, making sure they're transferred safely and properly refrigerated. I'm OCD about these things, he says. Another niche facility bonus, the privacy. While Brown still has to release positive results to local authorities, he says his big-name patients, big-name data, is more secure in the smaller lab than in a commercial spot. We have these clients that want absolute control, absolute privacy, he says, so we just get the job done. Brown's testing will run you $275, not including the house call charge, with more fees tacked on for weekends or holidays, or for special equipment like, you know, a chartered plane. Which, by the way, what did that cost? Brown guffaws. I invoiced him. COVID-19 has wrought lasting, horrific damage on the country, pushing millions of people out of work and killing more than 210,000. A disproportionate number of them people of color. But if the disease has upended our society, there are some slivers of Washington where people can afford an extra measure of comfort. On the hush-hush, of course. The parties are still on. Now the tasting menu comes to you. The kids are still in classrooms. They just might be newly installed high-design homerooms. And getaways still happen. They just might involve a new yacht rather than airplane tickets. Interior designer Josh Hildreth recently completed a backyard renovation for an Arlington family who didn't want to give up entertaining. They put in an outdoor living room with seating for 10, as well as a fire pit and a 66-inch TV for movie nights al fresco. The price tag? North of $400,000. While some redos started pre-pandemic, the stay-at-home life has increased their scope. Outdoor kitchens, pool houses and cabanas, new dog runs, putting greens. Now the in-home classroom is a thing. Interior designer Tracy Morris is outfitting one for the elementary school kids of a McLean, Virginia family. They're getting matching $1,265 desks, matching $569 lamps, matching $475 chairs, and a $2,250 sofa. In the self-care department, she's been working on home gyms. Her clients often request the Woodway, $5,950, or the almighty but elusive Peloton Tread. In homes in Georgetown and Great Falls, Virginia, Morris installed stations for manicurists to do house calls, as well as a portable hair washing sink so no one has to go out for their balayage. One of Hildreth's clients wanted to accessorize her Massachusetts Avenue Heights home with hand sanitizer, but didn't like the look of the plastic bottle. So she asked Hildreth to source some high-end trays and dispensers. Her final selection included a $470 set made from Capite shells, which she filled with a sanitizer from Italy. Nobody, said Hildreth, wants to feel like there's a medical cart in every room of their house. With flying vacations on hold, there's been a frenzy of boat sales. Pretty much everything we have in inventory is sold, said Mark Andrews, whose Annapolis Yacht Sales deals in a market you could call boutique nautique. His priciest pandemic sale so far, an $800,000-ish 54 Beneteau with three cabins. Unfortunately, the sailboat won't be ready till spring. Families, said Andrews, would go down to the islands or go over to the Mediterranean and charter a catamaran or a large sailboat for maybe 10 days at a time, a couple times a year. But not anymore. Some of them are buying boats, he said, because they've got the kids at home and they're running out of things to do. One problem that travel doesn't solve is that of staff. Houses, whether new, old, or floating, still need to be cleaned, and cooking still needs to be done. Stephanie Hecht is familiar with the resulting dilemmas. She runs a household staffing agency in Potomac whose clients include U.S. senators, sports teams' owners, and lawyers. A lot of lawyers. In the early Tom Hanks has COVID days of the pandemic, some paid their staff to stay home, then found themselves living almost like Hanks in Castaway. The wife of a CEO of a huge company who resides in Northwest D.C., Heck says, was going without her three housekeepers, her dog's caretaker, and her chef. The first time she went to cook, she burned herself. Solution: social distance from the help. In McLean, Heck has a family whose housekeeper still comes, but they never see her. She does the laundry, washes the groceries, and cooks from the second kitchen in the basement, then leaves it all at the top of the stairs. Private chef Kevin Brothers says one of his Baltimore clients has him prepare meals from the pool house, which the house manager helped upgrade with an Instant Pot and VitaPrep, the Aston Martin of blenders. He put their pistachio-crusted whitefish and roast chicken with some pomegranate reduction into oven-ready platters. Drops everything off at their back porch and texts them, "The dinner is ready." In other homes, the housekeeper or nanny has simply moved in. People who are really scared are taking private planes and going to Martha's Vineyard, going to Nantucket, Heck says. But short of that, if they're staying home, they're cautious, and they're keeping their help very close to them and knowing what they do. A lockdown housekeeper might be allowed to have a sibling or parent visit, outdoors only and 6 feet apart. But the families are opening up their goodies now, Heck says. That is, stay-at-home staff can use the pool and gym. Of course, even those whose quarantine is more luxury resort than last resort are subject to one great equalizer: more time at home. Like everyone else, the social set has moved a lot of its hobnobbing online, albeit with surroundings made for showing off. I do a background where my piano is, and that's on purpose, says publicist Janet Donovan, who still convenes off-the-record convos of prominent Washington women. "We were laughing because Pat Harrison has this great artwork behind her," she says of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting CEO, and her 17th century painting of Italy's Palio di Siena horse race. "And some of them make us jealous. They go out and sit in their pool." There are still galas, too, minus the tuxes and ball gowns. At the virtual gala for local Young President's Organization, guests chose between salmon and steak, and Susan Cage Caterers delivered the three-course meal to 80 homes. After the usual remarks, attendees were sent into Zoom breakout rooms, as if they all had table assignments. Businesses are hosting virtual parties for their top people, too. One D.C. law firm booked star sommelier Brett Kroll to lead a private virtual tasting for 100 VIP clients, who were shipped 4 bottles each. Headliners, it turns out, are only a phone call away. "They're not doing anything right now," says Harrison, the broadcasting exec. "Everyone's home, and you can't really say, 'Well, I was traveling.'" Harrison chairs the National Italian American Foundation, which usually lures names such as Sophia Loren or Martin Scorsese to its fall gala. This year it will honor the current most famous Italian American. Yes, Anthony Fauci. Harrison arranged everything with the infectious disease expert pre-COVID. But now the virtual bash is shaping up to be a hot ticket. "No question," she says. "Everyone wants to express their appreciation." Over the past few months, dinner parties have seemed to become a thing again, but small, with social distancing enforced lest a host repeat the scandal of the summer. Ashley Bronchek's Washington Ballet watch party. The hostess made headlines when she and some of her reportedly maskless guests, flouting the district's Phase 1 limit on gatherings of more than 10 people, tested positive for COVID after an insta-perfect soiree in her Spring Valley backyard. Undaunted hosts have found a new way to impress the invite list, bringing in the chef from their favorite restaurant. Pan Latin Hotspots, 7 Reasons, has been spooning out kvetches on Alexandria, Virginia patios for $120 a head, plus $500 to add a personal maitre d'. One of a number of restaurants feeding a demand for private in-home dining. At the residence of some of his 16th Street Heights customers, Kaz Sushi Bistro chef Kaz Okochi set up a sushi counter for a 26-course tasting that featured Japanese otoro and croaker fish fished locally by the chef's friend. The dinner for four came to $2,000. In Lux quarantine, there are no fashion victims. Rebecca Bex Jahangiri, a D.C. stylist who works with Kate Bennett of CNN and Susanna Quinn, the entrepreneur and fixture in D.C.'s social world, initially helped her clients with closet cleanouts, designating piles for donation and resale. but then it was time to shop. They're still posting on Instagram, says Jahagiri, of her clients, who pay $175 an hour or $2,000-ish a month for styling memberships. Regardless of what was happening, they wanted the newest Bottega Veneta shoes. They wanted the hottest bag. Jahagiri has all her clients' wardrobes digitized, so it wasn't the hugest deal to transition to virtual styling. Worse was when a bunch of luxury brands were forced to temporarily close stores and pause manufacturing. It's so funny, it was like people on drugs, she says. They were like, we haven't been able to go into a Chanel store or buy Chanel. Like, how do we get it? Money can't buy a vaccine, not yet anyway. But it seems it can buy all kinds of insurance. Some psychological protection against the dark. Haunting thought that parties and travel and big group dinners might be gone forever. Take Amina Muwadi heels. A pair of her sexy high shoes can run to $1,000. Yet Jahagiri's customers have been on a stampede. As soon as the shoes are in stock, they sell out. Buying things like that for the clients, Jahagiri says, just kind of gives them hope. In moments so bleak they seem almost like fiction, it turns out hope is the thing with stilettos. To cover all her bases one month, a woman in McLean put in an order for four pairs. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in the Washingtonian. We'll read one of the health and science pieces. Caught my eye. It's called Ants with Tools. Scientists have long considered ants to be dim-witted, rule-based creatures unable to think outside the box. But a new study suggests they're far more creative and intelligent than your average invertebrate. Like some other ant species, black imported fire ants are capable of tool use, using grains of sand to transport liquid food such as nectar back to their nest. To see if the insects could adapt this tool to overcome a dangerous obstacle, researchers filled several bottle cap-like containers with sugar water, catnip for ants, and then added a surfactant to reduce the water's surface tension. This stopped the ants, which have a water-resistant exoskeleton, from skimming across the surface and slurping up the sweet stuff, reports ScienceDaily.com. The researchers also provided them with a mound of sand. Before long, the ants were piling sand grains up around the container and in the water, allowing the bugs to siphon the liquid without risking drowning. Co-author Jian Chen, an entomologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, says the findings suggest that ants and other social insects may have considerable high cognitive capabilities for unique foraging strategies. We'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. Opposite of our last word article, we have one called Pandemic Poverty, a Growing Catastrophe. With federal stimulus checks long since spent and no more aid coming soon, many American workers and business owners have tumbled into financial disaster, said Eli Rosenberg and Heather Long in the Washington Post. Among them is Ninfa Rodriguez of Milwaukee, a 56-year-old who lost her job of 18 years at a casino in March. When her husband, a forklift lift driver, also lost his job this summer, the pair turned to credit cards to get by. My world has been turned upside down, she said. Wade Benz, owner of a logo printing business outside Nashville, has already reduced his workforce from 50 employees to 22 as his business plunged by 60%. He chokes up as he considers those remaining, many of them long-timers. I may have to look my workers in the eye soon and lay them off, he said. A staggering number of Americans are falling into poverty, said Jason DePaul in the New York Times. Since May, the number of poor in the U.S. has grown by 8 million, a new Columbia University study found. 6 million became poor over the past 3 months alone, according to a second study from the universities of Chicago and Notre Dame. Now that checks from the $2 trillion CARES Act have disappeared, Americans are having a lot more trouble paying their bills, paying their rent, putting food on the table, said economist Bruce Meyer. For those already living in or at the edge of poverty, the pandemic's effects have been especially devastating, said Jackie Mader in USA Today. Kenedsha Jones, an Army vet who has been supporting her four children with a job at a call center, now faces possible eviction and car repossession. To keep her kids fed, Jones is rationing food and hasn't eaten herself for as much as 3 days. The pandemic has dramatically widened income inequality in the U.S., said Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post. For professionals who can work via laptops and Zoom, life goes on. But for the bottom 25%, it has cratered. It's hard not to wonder if the relative normalcy of our life, of life for elites, has blinded us to the growing catastrophe. For tens of millions of Americans, this is the Great Depression. Can we please help them? Democracy, is too much of it dangerous? Senator Mike Lee just erected the intellectual scaffolding for minority rule, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. In a series of tweets, the Utah Republican said America is not a democracy, but a constitutional republic where elected delegates do the will of the people. Rank democracy, Lee tweeted, can thwart the pursuit of liberty, peace, and prosperity if the majority imposes its will on a minority. This is not a new argument. Conservatives have warned against the tyranny of the majority since Franklin Delano Roosevelt enacted a redistributive agenda in the Roosevelt era in the 1930s, and they resurrected the argument when Democrats enacted civil rights legislation in the 1960s. This time, Lee can see President Trump and Republicans headed for a big Election Day defeat. So he's masking the preemptive argument that for Democrats to implement their policy agenda is itself a form of tyranny. Lee has reason to fear democracy, said George Packer in TheAtlantic.com. He knows that America's demographic shift to minorities, youth, and cities all bodes poorly for Republicans' reliance on an ever-shrinking base of older white, male, rural, less educated voters. He also knows that Republicans will need to rely on the system's undemocratic features, the Supreme Court, the Electoral College, and the Senate filibuster, to thwart what clear majorities want. Actually, the founders built those institutions into our system for a reason, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. They purposely designed our government so as to cool mob passions. But now the left wants to use democracy to impose its cultural and ideological values on the entire country, and to demand widespread conformity on education, guns, health care, and marriage. Republicans often cite the will of the people, if it produces results they want, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. When Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell nullified President Obama's Supreme Court pick of Merrick Garland, he argued that the American people had a right to weigh in. When Lee voted to acquit President Trump after his impeachment trial, he said the Senate should not undo the vote taken by the American people to elect Trump. Yet when Republicans wish to defend disenfranchising ex-felons or gutting voting rights, they shout, "We're a republic, not a democracy." Poof. A legal reality of dubious legitimacy is transformed into a noble safeguard of American liberty. Let's see, we've got a few short notes here. Former Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey is urging Americans to wear masks after spending 7 days in intensive care being treated for COVID-19. I was wrong not to wear a mask, said Christie, who tested positive after attending a White House ceremony for Amy Coney Barrett. COVID, Christie said, is something to take very seriously. Since June, two Trump administration political operatives with no health background have been posted to the CDC's Atlanta headquarters, keeping an eye on the public statements of the agency's head, Dr. Robert Redfield. Joe Biden's town hall on ABC last Thursday drew more viewers than Donald Trump's competing town hall on NBC, even though the latter was broadcast on three networks. The Biden event averaged 15.1 million viewers, while the combined ratings for Trump's event across NBC and sister channels MSNBC and CNBC totaled 13.5 million. On the poll watch, 50% of Trump supporters say they believe top Democrats are involved in elite child sex trafficking ring, which is the central claim of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Only 16% of Trump voters say QAnon is a conspiracy theory with no basis in fact. And we'll finish with a quote from Noel Coward, quoted in the Daily Telegraph, who says, "Well, you live and learn. Then, of course, you die and forget it all." And on that note, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.